I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, and editor-in-chief Roy Johnson. Welcome, everybody. I may jump in here or there, but for now, take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, yo, fellas. What's up? Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey.
Doing good,
all right,
man.
Jimmy. Shaping up is the right word. That's what we're here for.
True.
You're the man, bro, and we're happy to have you. You know, President Barack Obama, he's trying to build bridges with the Muslim world. And, Michelle, we got some tape?
We have an abundance of tape. It was a very lengthy and comprehensive speech. I think we would all agree.
Minutes.
And I just have a very short clip. And, of course, we heard a clip of the speech earlier in our political conversation. But here it is. This is from his concluding remarks. Here it is.
The Holy Quran tells us, O mankind, we have created you, male and a female. And we have made you into nations and tribes so that you may know one another. The Talmud tells us the whole of the Torah is for the purpose of promoting peace. The Holy Bible tells us, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. The people of the world can live together in peace. We know that is God's vision. Now that must be our work here on earth.
All that Obama Kool-Aid is really making my teeth hurt. The arm, man, what did you think, bro? That's what I want to know. What did you think?
Well, listen, I think the stuff that he did right in this speech, I think, just leaped off the page. And one of them was where he went and he told this audience in Cairo not what they wanted to hear, but what they needed to hear. He talked about suicide bombers giving up the moral authority when they blow up buses that kill old ladies. You know, he put it out there. He said that this is not something we can continue to tolerate. He didn't just go there and pander to that audience. He challenged them. He pushed them back a little bit. And I think that was a really brave and bold thing to do, and good for him. I'm glad he did it. And I got to say, lastly, I think a lot of people out there are scratching their heads because you would never have heard him refer to Muslim this or that during the campaign. This is somebody who, during the campaign, was very sensitive to this idea that he was perceived to be a Muslim. And they established over and over again that he in fact, was a Christian. It isn't until he goes to the Middle East and to Saudi Arabia that he starts talking about his Muslim roots. So I think a lot of folks out there are scratching their heads saying, you know,
why should they be scratching their heads?
Go ahead, Roy.
The man was running for president, and clearly that was a hot-button issue that ultimately was not that important to the majority of the American people. But as a candidate, he certainly had to be sensitive to the fact that there was a perception there that at that juncture could sway a significant number of voters. So I don't know why these people are scratching their heads. It's like, duh, he was a candidate. Now he's a president of the United States.
That's right. A-Train, you wrote a really interesting piece on CNN.com. I'm really interested in your insights, man. Hit me.
Well, Barack Obama's Cairo address was a concert of enlightenment compared to the last farewell address of President George W. Bush, where he had two size 10 Iraqi shoes thrown at his
head. Hold on, everybody. Go ahead.
In this more than 40-minute speech, he tackled seven major foreign policy areas, from extremism to Iraq, AFPAC policies, Israel-Palestine, nuclear weapons, democracy, women's rights, and trade and development. Like LeBron James is to basketball, like Roger Federer is to tennis, like Tiger Woods is to golf, that is Barack Obama to global politics.
At least there's no hyperbole
that's
in that statement.
That's some loveration right there, baby. That's some love, baby.
Not a new
but
Arsene,
what was the most? What was the most resonant to you? What do you think was the most profound moment of the speech for you?
Well, by far one of
I think it's fair to point out, you know, Arsalan used to be the head of the Council on American Islamic Relations here, which is during 9/11.
I was their legal director.
The legal director. You know, as an American Muslim called upon to offer exactly this kind of commentary, to denounce extremism and to challenge some of these stereotypes. And so I think for you, if this had to have been a very interesting moment to hear the President of the United States take on some of these issues that you've
absolutely.
Worked on all these years.
And Ruben actually basically mentioned some of my talking points from my column when he's right when he says that during the presidential campaign, he didn't touch the American Muslim community with, you know, a 12-foot poll. And, you know, the first time he quoted a verse from the Holy Quran, I was like, did he really just say that? Because that was such a far step from what he had done. And it really shows that, you know, this man can't be pegged into a box.
Well, let me ask this, the goals of the speech, which is to, as he put it, reboot the relationship. Did he succeed? Did he make a down payment on that goal, Arsalan?
Oh, he paid the whole mortgage off.
Really?
Well, that was easy.
Oh, man.
We're done now. We're going to go home.
Roy.
I thought it was consistent with the theme that he has laid out from the very beginning, a theme of change, a theme of conciliation rather than violence. And this is a man that's about trying to rewrite the script that has been building for the last, 20, 30, 40 years, a script that got us to a place that has brought down our economy, that made the United States an isolated nation, that brought tension throughout the world, that has created untold violence. You know, it's a bold thing he's trying to do, but he is really trying to change that on many fronts. And now he's taken on the Muslim world, and it's going to be interesting to watch to see whether he can pull off some of the things that he talked about. But he did put the game out there.
Okay, this is Ruben. I applaud him for trying to move the needle, because it didn't really matter whether we had a Democrat in the White House or a Republican in the White House. We had the same consistent policy where we would say we were an honest broker, but we had our thumb on the scale, and we would typically favor Israel. And it created a great amount of cynicism on the Arab street and with Palestinians. Absolutely agree to that. We need to change that. But at the same time, it's sometimes easier said than done. What are we going to do the very first time that Israel sends planes up in the air to go bomb Iran, because Iran is that close to nuclear weapons? And so I'm not sure if Obama can deliver everything to everybody that he's promised.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Jimmy Israel, Roy Johnson, Ruben Navarrete, and Arsalan Iftikhar in the barbershop. Back to you, Jimmy.
You know what? We're keeping it in motion. You know, Conan O'Brien started his new joint, started a new era this week on late night TV as he took over The Tonight Show. Now, Conan O'Brien is a personal hero of mine. Dude, straight out of Harvard, writing that Harvard Lampoon, a great TV writer who, against the odds, really, was lifted up out of the obscurity to just become the man on his own joint on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He's brilliant, and he's doing his thing on this night show now, having taken the place of the Chin, Jay Leno. And we have some tape of Conan O'Brien getting comfortable in his new digs, right?
Yeah, he is. This is from his opening monologue during his first week hosting The Tonight Show. Here it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien. Thank you. I have to admit, I think I've timed this moment perfectly. Think about it. I'm on a last place network. I moved to a state that's bankrupt, and Tonight Show is sponsored by General Motors.
Whoa, nice.
A lot of people have been asking me, will your show be any different now that you've moved to Los Angeles? Yeah. And I tell them, no, mi programa no va a cambiar porque estoy.
Oh, man, Conan is brilliant. Thank you for that, Michelle. Roy, what do you think? How's he doing so far?
You know, he's a funny cat. Yeah, but I'm still aghast. Personal hero?
Mm-hmm.
Conan
O'Brien? Man.
Personal
yes, sir.
Hero? And
yes, sir.
I'm not sure what odds he defied. I mean, let's face it. Yes, he was not a traditional stand-up comedian, but you know, a funny looking white man in late night talk show. I mean, didn't defy huge odds there. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm as a TV writer, the odds were certainly against him for him to be plucked out of that bullpen and to be made into a talent on his own. You know, Jay Leno was already a comedian.
There've only been four Tonight Show hosts, and
there was Steve Allen, I believe. There was Jack Parr. There was Johnny Carson, and there was Jay Leno.
Right.
So he's number five.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So
it makes a good point, though. I guess curious about, I'm not hating, but I just am curious why late night is, I understand there's the generational shift that's gone on, so that's what's the news about Conan O'Brien taking over from Jay Leno, but I don't, why is there so little diversity? There's no Arsenio Hall, there's no Ellen DeGeneres, there's no, I just wonder why it is that given that there's so much diversity in the stand-up world that there's nobody seems to be considered in this chair.
Who are making the decisions.
I have an answer to that. I think in the case with hometown Arsenio Hall, Cleveland's own, I and some other people that have really tried to give it a try, I don't think they approached the game as writers. I think they thought that they could get up there and just tell one-liners, and there's so much more to that game than getting up there and telling one-liners. I mean, yeah, there's that. But, you know, I mean, Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, Johnny Carson, Craig Ferguson especially, these are all great writers. These cats sit down and they just get into it and they get the beat of the one-liners right. And you got to be relevant and you have to be, I mean, and Arsenio was just, just deferential and he just made funny faces.
This is Roy. Isn't it troubling, though, that we're talking about Arsenio, that there's no one that we can talk about since Arsenio's been on the air, that he still has to be the bar by which other
non-white
comedians
are male, non-white male. You know, I mean, Tina Fey made the jump from the writer's room to the head of
Tina Fey is the bomb.
Okay, this is Ruben. You know, George Lopez has a new deal to do a late-night talk show. But beyond that, the point is well taken. But Jimmy's point is, you know, just because you're a good stand-up comedian, you've got to understand television. You've got to know how to host a show, not just the writing. There is something that these guys have that isn't always easy to replicate, no matter how good you are doing stand-up.
And that's my point. A-Train.
Well, I mean, obviously it was a natural progression in terms of passing of the torch. You know, we have to also keep in mind that Jay Leno is moving up an hour earlier in the NBC time slot. So, you know, Conan's still going to follow Jay. So, you know, some of the main dynamic might be there. But the reason that I tuned in the first night was because he had musical guest the Mighty Pearl Jam. And so
Well, I'm eager to see what George Lopez has to say.
Let me just say for the record, as far as late night talk show hosts go, I would hope that a Latina comedian, okay, would a wiser Latina comedian would do a better job than a white male who hasn't lived that life.
The R, you were on the record, bro. And now from the world of sports, LeBron James takes his toys and mopes home after the loss of the Orlando Magic and gets the internet and the commish going nuts. Now, you and I may recall that after the game, my Cavs got knocked out by the Orlando Magic. LeBron took his Jordans straight to the locker room without shaking hands. What's up with that, Roy?
I think that many people, including myself, were disappointed to see him walk off the court. It was reminiscent, for those of you who have been basketball fans for a long time, of when the Detroit Pistons walked off the floor without shaking the hands of the opponents who vanquished them. And it's something that's been replayed for years. I think we're going to hear about LeBron's move for a long time, no matter what he happens to say with the commissioner. But I was even more troubled by what he said afterwards about why I have to shake someone's hand, the person that has beaten me. Oh. You know, that is one of the very foundations of sports and sportsmanship. Yeah. And I'm sitting there with my son watching the game and seeing him walk off the court and having to explain to him that that's not a good thing. If Rafael Nadal can hug the Swiss who defeated him in the French Open after more than 30 straight victories, if fighters can shake hands and hug each other, why can't LeBron James shake hands with Dwight Howard, another ambassador of the sport?
It's called character.
Can I say something? I completely take your point and I respect it. But one of the things that irks me about like female competition, like these beauty contests and so forth, is you just lost something that you presumably want. You trained very hard for, and then you're supposed to go up and hug the person who just beat you. I just find that bizarre. I mean, couldn't you have like a minute to get it together? Even fighters at the end of a fight don't have to to collect themselves.
That minute. Well, but he didn't even explain he didn't offer that the next day.
I know.
Well, now
I just find it strange.
And this is Arslan, and I think what makes LeBron James's case unique is the fact that he is LeBron James. This man had the Herculean task of essentially carrying the burden of a city, of an entire NBA franchise on his shoulders, the most valuable player in the NBA. Those of us who aren't even Cavs fans were rooting for him to win. And I just think that it was LeBron doing a very un-LeBron thing. He's historically been very good with the media in terms of relationships with other teams and things like that. You know, in fairness, I'm going to have to give him the redunculus of the week. But I don't think LeBron would ever do that again in a high-profile situation like that.
Speaking of basketball, who's going to the dance? Left to right, my left, stereo left to right, the R. Who's going to the dance this year?
Yeah, are the Celtics still in it?
No.
Okay, well,
That's my team.
The Celtics are not in it.
Roy, my man.
I think it's going to be a great series. I think Orlando has demonstrated an ability to withstand whatever comes at them. They beat the defending champions. They defeated America's team, or at least America's player. And now they're going up against the Black Mamba, Kobe Bryant. Everyone believes that the Lakers, because of the uniform, have the advantage. But I'm going to go with the magic, and I'm doing it in part because I think the 2-3-2 format nullifies to a degree the home court advantage. The Lakers have been too inconsistent in these playoffs. Their front court and their back court have been inconsistent. They have great talent up front, and certainly they have the best player on the floor. But I love the Magic. I think they're going to be difficult to defend, just as the Cavs never figured out how to defend them. You got to pick your poison.
Now.
And I, so I'm going with the Magic. And
that was comprehensive, baby.
This is it. This is this is Arsalan, and I'm going to have to co-sign my man Roy here. I mean, you know, underlying this whole LeBron story, the Orlando Magic, I mean, Dwight Howard, Hedo Turkoglu, Rashard Lewis are a bunch of stone-cold killers. I mean, the Cavs got took. And when Dwight Howard gets it clean underneath the basket, it's please hammer, don't hurt him. I think they steal one in Los Angeles. If it goes to six games, the Magic win. If it goes to seven, unfortunately, Kobe will win.
You know what? The Magic took out my Cavs, so I have to – I'm down with Kobe. I'm all about L.A., so that's my pick. And I think that's a wrap, gentlemen, taking the ball straight to the hole. I want to thank you so much for coming to the shop. And now it's time for me to pass the ball to the lady of the house, Michelle Martin.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com and TV One Online. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Ruben Navarrete writes for the San Diego Union-Tribune and CNN.com, and he joined us from San Diego. Roy Johnson is editor-in-chief of Men's Fitness Magazine. He joined us from our bureau in New York. And Arsalan Iftikhar is the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and a civil rights attorney. He joined us from our studios in Washington. Gentlemen, thank you all so much.
Peace.
Thank you.
Later.
Yep, yep. We'll be right back.